Lecture 9, Kierkegaard's Existential Dialectic.
Kierkegaard's rejection of Hegel might be viewed along two different dimensions. On the one hand, there is Kierkegaard's thorough rejection of Hegel's collective notion, the idea that the individual is unimportant. But second, Hegel's notion of spirit was distinctive in that it was firmly historical. One has said that Hegel invented history. This is, of course, an exaggeration. There's a sense in which, of course, there was history back among the Greeks, Herodotus and Thucydides. And, of course, people have been writing history for thousands of years. But there's a sense in which Hegel developed an idea which only really became manifest in the 19th century. And it was the idea that history has a purpose, that history is the evolution of something. This, of course, manifested itself 50 years later in Darwin. But in Hegel, it pretty much was confined to the human, and the idea that the human spirit was something that evolved over huge amounts of time. And Hegel went back to the ancient Greeks, even went back to the Chinese, and talked about how this human spirit developed over history in this kind of massive, non-individualistic way. Kierkegaard rejects the second dimension too, and for many of the same reasons that he rejects the first. He rejects the emphasis on spirit as opposed to the emphasis on the individual because it leaves out what he and many people following him would say is most important, and that is philosophy should tell you how to live your life, you personally. And that means ultimately it comes down to the ethically existing individual. But second, the idea of understanding this purpose of history, something which Hegel very dramatically developed, and the idea is that history has evolved to the point where we understand ourselves as universal spirit. That historical dimension is something that Kierkegaard also wanted to reject. Because after all, wherever we are on the historical trajectory, that really doesn't help us make the kinds of decisions we have to make. Hegel called this historical development, this purposiveness, by the rather exciting Greek name, dialectic. And one might say that Hegel's philosophy is, among other things, about a historical dialectic that shows us where we've come from, where we're going, and where we are. Kierkegaard, by contrast, also takes the notion of a dialectic, but he makes it strictly personal. He calls it an existential dialectic. And the idea is that while there may well be the kind of interplay that Hegel had talked about in great detail, in history, there is also, and more importantly, a kind of interplay within each and every individual. The notion of dialectic itself is fascinating. It gets traced back to the Greeks. It's a Greek word. Plato and Aristotle talked about it, and it is often said that dialectic is, in one rather banal translation, simply a conversation. But in its sort of proceeding through history, through philosophy, dialectic takes on a much more dramatic sensibility. It's not just a conversation, but it's a confrontation. And in particular, Hegel's thesis was that history proceeds through one mode of consciousness, one way of thinking, one way of living, in conflict with another, until the conflict itself produces a kind of offspring, which may be a synthesis of the two antitheses, or it may be something else entirely. But the idea is that history develops, and it develops in particular through conflict. It's an idea which was picked up by Kierkegaard's exact contemporary, Karl Marx, who turned Hegel's historical intellectual dialectic into something that was much more material and sociological. But in Kierkegaard, the idea of a dialectic has to do not with warring forces in history, it has to do not with warring ideas as such, but rather it has to do with what goes on in a subjective individual as he or she tries to make the decisions that are going to define his or her life. The personal dialectic is one that is existential in precisely the sense that it has to do with this notion of existence taking a hold of one's life, making commitments, passionately throwing oneself into one way of life or another. Kierkegaard talks about modes of existence, or we might even say, and he uses a term like this, that they are lifestyles, except that term is a little bit corrupted from California overuse. But the idea is that there are different ways of living. And in addition to making the particular decisions we make about what to do or how to act, we also make some very general, broad decisions about how we're to live. Just to take a kind of homey example for us, deciding to join the Marines would be choosing a lifestyle, choosing a mode of existence. There's a sense in which one simple decision can get you in, but no simple decision can get you out. There's a sense in which once you've entered into this lifestyle, you are truly committed. And once you enter into the lifestyle, of course, there are all sorts of structural and institutional reasons why you stay in that lifestyle. Getting married, and let's think of it in the 19th century context rather than the 20th century context, but deciding to get married is to choose a lifestyle. And as you can guess from what little I've told you about Kierkegaard's autobiography, it's going to be the major examples of his notion of a dialectic, whether or not to get married. It's not simply a choice of what do we do for the next few years, but it really is a question about what kind of person do I want to become. The important point here is that there is no rational standard for such choices. In other words, it is strictly in the realm of subjectivity, not objectivity. In Hegel, the dialectic was, in an important sense, objective. It was rational. And so that by understanding this trajectory of history, one would understand not just the way things have been, but one would understand the way things, in some sense, have to go. There is no such notion in Kierkegaard. The choosing between lifestyles, choosing whether, for example, to be a religious person or an atheist, choosing whether or not to be an ethical person, or rather, an immoralist. All of this is a matter of choice. And in fact, what he gives us, perhaps oversimply, are three different modes of existence, three different lifestyles. And the important point is, again, that there is no rational way of choosing among them. It is simply a matter of subjective choice. The three styles, very quickly, are something he calls the aesthetic. And as I indicated in the first lecture, the aesthetic for him refers primarily to the life of pleasure. It refers to the idea that one lives for satisfaction. And I want to talk about that in some detail in a few minutes. Second lifestyle is called the ethical. And the ethical life is basically the life of, as you would guess, morality. It's doing your duty, fulfilling your obligations, keeping your promises, being a good person, caring about the welfare of others as well as yourself. And the third lifestyle, needless to say, is the religious life. And Kierkegaard juxtaposes these against one another and says that it is a choice that we have to make. With regard to the aesthetic, one might argue that this is not a choice. It's simply natural. There have certainly been a great many philosophers. The utilitarians, who are more or less Kierkegaard's contemporaries, would be one example, who would say that pleasure is the natural end or purpose of human activity. Or, on the other side, avoidance of pain, which is sort of negative pleasure, is the purpose, the aim of human activity. This is true not only of human beings, it's true of virtually all creatures, certainly all creatures of any sophistication. And consequently, to talk about it as a choice really doesn't make any sense. It's just what people do. And lots of philosophers would say that it is simply a matter of logic, a kind of conceptual truth, that people do what they want to do. People do what will give them satisfaction, or think will give them satisfaction. People do what will give them a pleasure or help them to avoid pain. It's just natural. It's not a choice at all. But thinking about Kierkegaard's own life, we realize what it means to say that it's a choice. True, Kierkegaard discovered in his year of libertinage with his friend Hans Christian Andersen that the life of pleasure was not for him. But that wasn't just a recognition. It wasn't just saying, I'm a person who is anhedonic. I'm a person who doesn't enjoy enjoying himself. but it's rather making a decision that you are going to live one kind of life rather than another. One can imagine Kierkegaard, and certainly one knows lots of people who are similarly anhedonic, who don't enjoy themselves very much, resolving to learn to enjoy themselves, taking all sorts of great steps, often overstepping boundaries, precisely in order to enjoy themselves when they do not now. Kierkegaard, of course, takes the opposite tact and says, I'm not enjoying myself. Maybe this is telling me something important about myself and what I'm supposed to do. And so he decides, and it is a decision, not to pursue pleasure. The aesthetic life, in general, can be defined in terms of not so much the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, although that's an important part of it. After all, the very word aesthetic essentially comes from the Greek having to do with feeling. But it also has to do with something broader, and that's the notion of satisfaction. One might say that the aesthetic is a life devoted to personal satisfaction. It is not necessarily ethical, although I should add it's not necessarily unethical. It is not necessarily unreligious either. It's a question of priorities. And to choose the aesthetic life is to decide that your personal satisfaction is the most important thing for you. Kierkegaard has an example, rather controversial example, of the aesthetic life. One of his favorite operas was Don Giovanni, Mozart's great opera. I'm often fascinated by the thought that before you had record players and CDs and cassettes and Walkmen and so on, that people would hear their favorite piece of music perhaps a half dozen number of times in their lifetime. That's really kind of striking. Anyway, Kierkegaard saw Don Giovanni every chance he got. He loved the opera, and there's a sense in which the character of Don Juan plays a role throughout his philosophy. When he writes, for example, about seduction, with reference, for example, to seducing his readers, but when he writes about seduction in a rather straightforward sexual sense, it's Don Juan that he has in mind. Now, if you think about who was Don Juan, the short answer is he was a man who pursued his own pleasures quite to the exclusion of any real consideration of other people. According to the libretto, it was 1,003 in Spain alone. Well, he couldn't have cared that much about any one of them. They were simply used. And of course, thinking of the opera, you realize that not only is he callous about the women he sleeps with, but he is, in a way, indifferent to human life. When he has to sacrifice the father of one of his conquests, he does so without even a pang of conscience. As I said, it's not necessary to be immoral in order to be aesthetic, but nevertheless, as a question of priorities, it is a matter of, when the chips are down, choosing your own satisfaction over anything else. The aesthetic life isn't necessarily quite so vulgar, and as a kind of contrast to Don Juan, let me take as an example Mozart himself. Mozart was also an aesthetic, and here we move from the early 19th century meaning of the word aesthetic having to do with feeling to the later 19th century meaning of that same word, where it has to do with art and artistry. Mozart was aesthetic in the latter sense, and if you accept the story in Amadeus, let's exclude Mozart's behavior under the piano, just talk about his behavior on top of the piano. But basically, Mozart was someone who lived for satisfaction too. But his satisfaction wasn't the conquest of women. His satisfaction was, in each case, the composition of a perfect piece of music. It may well have been that it also satisfied the standards of the time, that it was, in fact, in tune with the culture, but the truth was that Mozart was satisfying himself. If he wrote an imperfect piece of music, he was the one who would toss it away. If he wrote a perfect piece of music, he was satisfied, and often quite regardless of how it sort of played for his audience. So you might think of Mozart, too, as aesthetic in the sense that he lived for satisfaction. The problem, Kierkegaard says, is that the aesthetic life, like any life, has its own liability. And that liability is most obvious in the question of boredom. Don Juan is a good example. There's a sense in which one imagines what it would be like to have so many sexual partners. And there's a point where one wants to say, how can you tell them apart? Isn't one just like the others? And many writers on the Don Juan problem have come up with some rather extravagant metaphysical ways of expressing this. For example, the fact that Don Juan didn't love women, what he loved was woman writ large. Well, all of this is a way of dancing around the real problem. And the problem is that when it's simply desire and satisfaction, there's a point where satisfaction becomes more and more difficult, where it becomes more and more all the same, where repeating something an indefinite number of times becomes inevitably tedious. And here, of course, we go back to Sisyphus. And Kierkegaard is very concerned with this question of repetition. He writes actually rather extensively about it and the ways in which one can prevent the repetition of the same from becoming totally boring, totally tedious. And what he says is that essentially, what Camus is later to say, one has to commit oneself, one passionately throws oneself into one's activities themselves, and by so doing, evades boredom at least for a while. But the truth is, one can't do it. And here Kierkegaard is presenting us with something that might sometimes be taken as a kind of objective psychological truth, but I think that would be misreading him, since he so strongly wants to emphasize the subjective side of this. And certainly it was true of him. It was certainly true of most of the people he knew. And even without making it a point of scientific psychology, one can easily understand the logic of becoming jaded. One becomes tired of the pleasures which one has hitherto enjoyed. Or, to put it in a different way, one is never really satisfied. The great German poet Goethe, in Faust, writes, "From desire I rush to satisfaction, but from satisfaction I leap to desire." Every time you satisfy a desire, a new one takes its place. So if the aim of the aesthetic life is satisfaction, there is a sense in which this is impossible. There is always frustration, there is always dissatisfaction, and in the end, there may well be only boredom, being jaded. At which point, one who has chosen the aesthetic life faces a crisis. And the crisis is to continue in this self-defeating way, or to choose something else. Now again, that all-important point. This is not a matter of logic. This is not a matter of rationality. It is simply a matter of trying to understand what one is feeling, what one feels that one needs out of life, and making the appropriate choices. But one could, and one knows such people, stay in the aesthetic mode of existence even long after one is well past the possibility of satisfaction, even past the possibility of pleasure, where it is just a life of jaded cynicism and nothing else. However, there is an alternative. The most immediate alternative is the ethical mode of existence, the ethical lifestyle. Now, I said in the last lecture, perhaps a bit cryptically, that the ethical mode of existence is also on the side of subjectivity. It's an objective uncertainty. It is something that must be chosen and passionately committed to. And it is not simply something that can be proven by a philosophical analysis. Of course, such proofs abound in philosophy. The most famous is by the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who tried to show that morality was nothing less than rationality itself. But then that still leaves an interesting question, which Kant himself didn't want to face. Why should I be rational? Why should I choose the ethical mode just because it is the rational mode? Couldn't I rather choose against rationality? Or could it be that the ethical mode is just, as one philosopher has put it, a moral point of view, but it's one point of view among many? The idea that ethics is somehow objective, that there are truths about the world or truths of human nature that make it a compulsory choice, is something that Kierkegaard wants to reject. Which isn't to say that he rejects rationality in ethics, But rather what he wants to say is the choice of being ethical itself is not a rational choice. One can choose to be ethical or one can choose not to be ethical. And ethically, there is nothing much to say. The ethical lifestyle can be rather simply defined in a number of ways. It can be defined as the life of duty and obligation. And in one sense, that takes us all the way back to ancient times. The idea in Aristotle, for example, that one has to do what one is supposed to do. Or Kant has a much more vigorous and rationalistic idea that what defines morality, what defines the ethical lifestyle, is definition by universal moral principles, principles of reason. And Kierkegaard, in fact, accepts this as his definition. And when he talks about morality, when he talks about ethics and the ethical style, what he's usually talking about is, either directly or indirectly, ethics, morality, as defined by Kant. Categorical imperatives which tell us what our obligations, what our duties are. Matters of reason, not matters, for Kant, of subjectivity at all. But, very interesting, they may be moral principles which are universal by way of reason, but reason is here construed as internal to the ethical life. It is not something which transcends it in such a way that we can choose the ethical life as such, rationally. Rather, to choose the ethical life is to choose to be rational, which means to follow the moral principles such as Kant set them out. One might also say that the ethical life, as opposed to the aesthetic life, is other-directed, in the sense that it is defined by concern for others. And one example that Kierkegaard gives here is Socrates. Now, Socrates is an interesting case here, too, because there's a sense which Socrates, like Kant, was not particularly devoted to the idea of the well-being of others, so much as he was concerned with the kinds of virtues, or in Kant, the kinds of moral principles, which are essential to morality or ethics itself. The idea is that to be a good person, in Socrates' case, is to be concerned with doing the right thing, with being virtuous above all else. And of course, the most dramatic single case in the history of philosophy. Socrates, when his virtue was challenged, when he was condemned to death by the Greek jury, and essentially had a choice between violating his obligations or dying, what he chose was death. Again, the idea of ethics here is something which is rational within, but not necessarily rationally chosen. But let's take an example. And the example is one that is absolutely essential to Kierkegaard's own life, consequently it plays a large role in his philosophy. Suppose you're deciding whether or not to get married. And again, I ask you to put yourself back in the middle of the 19th century instead of the much more casual notion of marriage we seem to have today. To decide whether or not to get married for Kierkegaard is to decide between two things. On the one hand, there's the aesthetic, the idea of trying to be happy, trying to get pleasure out of life, trying to be satisfied. On the other hand, there is the ethical, where it has to do with obligation and duty. Now, one might draw this in a very different way, and Kierkegaard, in fact, himself, tends to fudge this when he actually writes in detail about it. But suppose you saw the life of a male bachelor as a life of satisfaction, a life of aestheticism in the sense of just going after pleasure and satisfying your desires. And by contrast, you saw marriage as a kind of realm of ethical duty. And one talks, I think, rather horribly about the idea of conjugal duties, something that is done quite willingly as a bachelor seems to be a matter of obligation when you're married. But anyway, this distinction between the aesthetic and the ethical plays a rather large role in this instance. And one might say that when one chooses whether or not to get married, what one is really choosing is a lifestyle, a mode of existence. To choose to be a bachelor is to remain more or less unconstrained, without obligation, free to do what one wants to do. To choose to get married, by contrast, is to choose a life of obligations and a sense in which there are all kinds of principles and rational ways of thinking about what one is obliged to do. Kierkegaard himself would say There is no rational way of making this choice. You have to look at yourself, you have to figure out what you want out of life, what kind of person you are, and then you have to make a leap. And as we all know, getting married, no matter how passionate to begin with, is always a kind of leap of faith. One never knows exactly what's to follow, and one does it and takes one's chances. Kierkegaard has a lot of powerful things to say about the ethical life. And as I said, in a way he cheats a bit with the marriage question by, in the end, having the spokesperson he invents to talk in favor of marriage. Conclude with the discussion of marital bliss, which of course is basically an aesthetic notion to begin with. And of course here what Kierkegaard is saying is, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can get married, and if it's a happy marriage, you can be satisfied and get lots of pleasure and at the same time fulfill your duties. But as I said, the important point is priorities. And I guess the sort of sad question here is, what are your obligations when the marriage goes sour? And certainly in the 19th century there was a very strong sensibility that you have obligations and your personal happiness and satisfaction is secondary. But the ethical life too has its liabilities. And in this case, it's not going to be dissatisfaction, that's still an aesthetic notion, but it's going to be a kind of frustration. And we've all faced this. It's the idea that there are more wrongs in the world than can be righted. And we ourselves are very often helpless in the face of injustice. There's a notion that's been circulating the last several years. It's called compassion burnout. And it applies to those of us who give rather heavily to charity. But basically, it has to do with receiving notice after notice. I'm only guessing, maybe 500 solicitations a year, many of them from outfits which are essentially serving the same causes. For example, I'm on about 10 different wildlife preservation lists. And there's a point where you get tired. You get tired of making the decisions. It's not so much that you're unwilling to give, but it's just realizing you can't help everyone who needs help. And one of the consequences in the larger society seems to be that, at least for a period, people were not giving anymore because they were getting tired of the solicitations. They were getting tired of doing something but not doing enough. And that's the problem with ethics, that if you really devote yourself to the rational life of morality, if you devote yourself to the well-being of your fellow human beings, you are always going to be frustrated by the fact that things don't usually work out right, precisely what Camus would later describe as the absurd. But of course, there's another choice. And again, it is not a rational choice. It is a choice that one must make on the basis of one's own subjectivity. And that's the religious way of life. Again, what Kierkegaard has in mind here is Christianity, more particularly Lutheranism, more particularly his own personal interpretation of what that amounts to in terms of internal inwardness and subjectivity. But there's a sense in which you might say, in what sense is this an exclusive choice? I mean, after all, isn't the whole Judeo-Christian tradition about ethics? Or isn't the ethics just as important to it as the religious part? In fact, there have been some recent philosophers, in fact, people who follow Kierkegaard, who have said, in effect, that we don't need the theology. You can be a good Christian if you just lead an ethical life. So there's a question here in Kierkegaard. In what sense is the ethical and the religious to be opposed? He gives us a story. The story is the story of Abraham, and it involves what is probably the most terrible commandment in the entire Old Testament. It is when God tells Abraham that the son for whom he has longed so far, so long, and the son whom he has now brought up as a healthy young man, must be sacrificed as a proof of his faith. What is Abraham to do? On the one hand, there is no moral commandment more important than the commandment which says, in effect, you don't harm members of your family. At the same time, what could be more a violation of the religious way of life than not obeying a direct order from God? Of course, God makes it come out okay. He stops the sacrifice before it takes place. But Kierkegaard says, here's an instance in which the religious and the ethical go firmly against one another. And in the name of faith, What Abraham has to do is what he calls a teleological suspension of the ethical. In other words, the religious has priority, the ethical does not. Abraham, like Kierkegaard, had made the leap of faith. But so too, Kierkegaard says, must we.